Good evening and welcome to Race Talk. Welcome everybody. I hope you're having a pleasant evening. And I've got something I'm going to introduce you to shortly. But first, a boy on his paper route in his tiny Ohio hometown heard the sound of engines down in the valley. He followed the irresistible racket until he discovered some older boys tearing it up in a field on their go-karts. Suddenly, his bicycle lost all its appeal. Soon, he delivered his papers from a wagon towed behind his brand-new yard cart, and he looked for a way to join the local cart club. So his dad built a track for them, and his dream of racing exploded. This was Doc Bundy, and he's been called Doc all his life. He grew up in Scio, Ohio, in the middle of nowhere, at a time when there were more local dirt tracks than there were bowling alleys. He'd seen plenty of weekend barn burners at tracks around him, but then came the day he went with friends to Mid-Ohio and saw a Can-Am race. It changed his life. After he completed high school, he went to the Humboldt Institute in Minneapolis to get a degree in airline management. He then came a series of jobs at O'Hare in Chicago and the Akron-Canton Airport. But along came Vietnam, and he was drafted. He did his two-year tour in country, then came home in 1968 to Ohio, where he had a Corvette waiting for him. His first foray into racing was driving a Lotus 22 Form C at Mid-Ohio, mostly for fun and an experience. But he knew he needed to get a job with the team to learn the ropes. He hired on to Peter Gregg's team in 73 and moved to Jacksonville, Florida, where he really started at the bottom. And after a year and a half, he was still a gopher. So through a series of lucky breaks, he struck up a friendship with Al Hobert, who offered him a real job in Warrington, Pennsylvania. He stayed with Hobert's team for about 5 years, learning his track skills there in a variety of cars. Eventually, Doc drove for numerous teams, sharing rides with the great, the future great, and the not as great as they thought they were. He's driven Corvettes, Porsches, Zach Speeds, Probes, Jaguars, Panoses, etc. He's raced 5 times at Le Mans and all over the states, and IMSA, and its collection of support series and incarnations, Trans Am and SCCA. When he entered into semi-retirement in 2011, he signed on with good friend Paul Rego and his eclectic HSR Rigogo team in a Lotus 23Bs and the restored Mario Andretti's Lotus 79 John Player Special Formula One car. But then he found time to get sick. A near-death round of COVID-19 and heart problems put him out of commission for a while. But he bounced back and raced for Rigogo late last season, winning 2 races in his first time back in the car. Now he's looking forward to a much better 2021 racing season. Doc Bundy is a man with a million stories. Let's hear a few of them tonight. Welcome to Race Talk, Doc. Mute your phones, people.
Thank you, Trish.
Thank you.
Well, that was pretty good. You hit across all everything. You just said my little hometown incorrectly.
Let's say it right. Scio.
No, it's Scio. Scio.
I would never
S-C-I-O.
Have
Scio. And I know because it's so unique, and you know it was so tiny that not many people even knew where it was.
It's a good place to be from.
Yeah, it's a good place to be from. About a mile away was a little, an even tinier community, probably like, 8 or 10 houses. And it was a place called New Rumley. And what it was known for is it had a statue there. And the statue was of General George Custer.
Boo.
Yes, but the funny thing about that was that the statue had a sword, and I think every year the senior class, graduating class, steal the sword and stash it somewhere in school. And then, you know, it would eventually back end up back on the statue. But
where do you want to start about your racing career?
Well, like you said, I started in go-karts and had a lot of success early on. And my family didn't have much. They couldn't really do anything for me car-wise. But my father loved racing, and so he was supportive of what I wanted to do. My mother, she wasn't so sure, but eventually we won her over. And like you said, I accepted, or I won a position with Brumos, with Peter Gregg down in Jacksonville, as a gopher. I had to compete with three other guys for the job. And I think we did two races before I was officially hired. And that was a really good experience. I think that year we won the first five races of the season in IMSA. So I was very impressed, very impressed. And, of course, at one point he said, what is it your goal are? And I said, I'm going to be a driver. And he laughed. And he says, there's no way. It ain't going to happen, son. But that just inspired me. So I finished the first year. During the first year, I met Al Holbert because Al had started racing in IMSA and had a similar car. He had the Donahue Porsche Carrera back in 73. And Peter had the other Carrera, which was the Brumos Carrera. And Al's was different in that Al, being an engineer, he did a lot more with the roll cage, and he was on top of everything as far as preparation goes. And at one point, he had a spare 3-liter, and the cars originally come with a 2.7-liter. And so Peter sent me to Warrington, Pennsylvania, from Jacksonville, Florida, to pick up that spare engine from Al. Al sold him that engine. To this day, I don't quite understand why Al would sell his toughest competitor the same engine he had, but he did. That was kind of Al. He was a good guy, really good guy. And that weekend, I ended up spending there with him, and he offered me a job because we just hit it off in a way like we both had the same philosophy and the same desire when it come to racing, even though I didn't have near the experience he did. Because he came from a racing background. His father, Bob Holbert, drove for Shelby and Porsche and was very successful himself. But eventually I finished that year with Brumos and did one more year, and then gave my notice, I think middle of summer that second year, told Peter that I would train the next gopher how to do the job properly. And Peter could be tough. He was a tough task master. And you never knew what to expect when he walked in, whether he was going to be supportive or highly critical. But when I finished that second year, we had a team Christmas party, and he gave me a handwritten letter of recommendation, which really surprised me, and said if I ever wanted, to come back to the team, I was more than welcome. So that made me feel pretty good. But I knew there was no driving for me at Brumos. It just would never happen. With Al, Al was more open. I mean, I couldn't drive with him because I didn't have the experience to run at his level. I had way too much to learn. But I did a lot of, I did more at his, at Hobart Racing than I ever did at Brumos. And I was, I kind of, Al ran the team, but I was kind of like, oh, like a manager of the race shop. So I would go out and look for sponsorships and put together little deals. And eventually I got to put together a deal that allowed me to actually drive a car. And it wasn't the best outing, but it was interesting. It was interesting.
Tell us. Your one job is to keep the job your foster and safe.
Please don't be angry with us. We did the best we could to make it comfortable here.
Everybody mute your phones, please. Doc, are you with me?
Yep, I'm there. I'm here. I wasn't sure if there was a question coming, so that's why.
I didn't know either. Well, tell me, well, you're still talking about Al Hobart's experience, and I really want to hear more about that.
Best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
He literally went out on the limb for me, and I didn't really know it at the time. I just worked really hard and just thought, okay, well, this is my reward. I get to drive this car. And it was more than that. He had to convince the head of Porsche Motorsport to let me drive the car because they wanted to win a championship with it. And I didn't have that much experience. I had done a few one-off races. But each race I would do, you know, I was gaining experience, so I would get better and better. And the cars that I got to drive, you know, I put deals together for Al, but they really included me. Like at 24 hours of Daytona, you know, I did a deal with a Porsche team and told them they have to, Al would bring a Goodyear contract, which would save him a huge amount of money. And but they had to include me as one of the drivers. And they bought it. They bought it, and I can't tell you how we finished, but it was a great experience. It was in a Porsche 935, so a fast car, very fast car. And I took that experience, you know, and the big difference with Al was that, is that he did a lot of testing. You know, he had worked at, when he was in college, he had worked with Penske Racing. So he was friends with Mark Donahue, and Mark would call him all the time and say, hey, we're going testing. You want to pack up your car and bring it to this track, you know, and tell us where. We'd go to the other end of the pit lane, and we'd do our testing stuff. And back in those days, everything that we had on the truck, Al would try on the car. And I would go, why are we doing all this? Those early Porsches were difficult to set up, and you'd chase camber and toe and weight back and forth across the car. I mean, it was really tricky to set up, but what I learned was, when I actually got to start driving, Al never ever told me how to drive. This is unique. But he would ask questions, and by my answers, he knew where I was in my driving knowledge at that time, in my understanding of the car. But he always pointed out to me, the car can be perfect. You just have to keep searching for what, and for what makes it do everything you need it to do. And I never lost that. There's not a lot of teams that break it down to that simple, but he did, and I'm grateful for that. It's allowed me to have a lot of success over the years. It's not like the driver wasn't important, but he would say, he says, it's the car that wins the race, Doc. It's the car that wins. But you've got to get it to where it's capable of winning. So it was a wonderful experience. Scary in the beginning. I remember the first race we did with the 924. He didn't go to the race, so I would call him at night from the hotel we were staying in, motel, which was a little place in Briar, New Hampshire. And it was Memorial Day weekend, and he said, "Well, you're going to race against a Lotus 7, and at that track, he'll probably eat your lunch." He said, "But if your national, your SCCA national will be on Sunday." And he said, "If there was a regional on Monday." He said, "If he doesn't stay for the regional, then stay because we need a victory." At the time, I didn't quite understand. We need a victory. We want victories. So anyhow, as it turned out, I won that race. And it wasn't on speed. My competitor had a flat tire in the race, came in, and he had a one-man crew, and all they had was a speed wrench. My crew ran over with an air gun and changed these tires. And so he ended up second. He was able to not lose a lap. But the only tire he had was like a rain tire, so he couldn't run as fast. He just didn't have the grip. So after the race, when we got to checkered flag, I was pretty happy, you know. Well, we got second. And I went to go in the pits, and they said, "No, go ahead, go over to the starter." Well, I had got a phenomenal start at the beginning of that race, and I actually went from fourth to first into the first turn. So I thought, "Oh no, they think I jumped the starts," and I'm going driving over to the starter stand, thinking I'm going to defend myself. I did not jump that start. Turned out, the guy. When I pulled up, he handed me the checkered flag. I said, "No, no, no, no. I finished second." And he goes, "No, you won." I said, "No, I finished second." And because I had never knowingly passed the Lotus 7, but I had when he was in the pit. I wasn't aware of that. So I come back over, and my team was so excited. So we packed up and went home, back to Warrington. Because we won the national, I didn't see any reason to run a regional. The points didn't mean anything. So we got back in like the wee hours in the morning. We didn't call anybody. Tom, my crew chief, called his wife and said, Doc's going to stay. He's going to sleep on the couch at our place. We're driving back tonight. So this is before cell phones. So, or if there were cell phones, none of us had any. So we got back there and the next we back to the rig up to the race shop and unloaded the car and put the trophy on the hood of the car, and then figured, well, we'll go back, you know, on Monday and unload the rig. And so we're sleeping, and the phone rings, and it's Al calling. And he saw that we were back, and he called Tom, and his wife answered the phones. She says, yeah, Doc's here. So they put me on the phone, and I talked to him. I realized after a few minutes of talking that he never walked back and looked at the car to see the trophy that was sitting on the roof of it. And so I took great delight in teasing him for a little while. And then finally he kept saying, how bad is it? He thought I'd crashed or something. He said, because we didn't stay. So as it turned out, no, it was fine. And he got so excited, he called Mr. Hoppin, who was the Porsche racing director. That morning he called him, said, we won, we won, we won. We're the first, we're the first. And what I didn't know until years later is Al had gone out on the limb for me to get to drive that car, because Porsche wanted an experienced driver in it to try and win the national championship with it. And we did pretty good. I think we won nine races out of 12 in the national championship. So we did good that first year.
I love it.
And that just propelled me slowly, but it propelled me into the next level car, which was a turbocharged version of that car that I ran in Trans Am. And just, you know, that's kind of how things progressed for me and allowed me to move up into different cars. But the whole time I had a wonderful, wonderful working relationship with Al. We were like, he was like my brother. So when he died in that plane crash, I took it pretty hard, really hard.
I understand that.
One race that I had done, which was a big step forward for me, was in the Porsche 934. At that time, IMSA didn't allow that car to compete in IMSA. So Porsche had made a deal where it ran Trans Am with the SECA. And there was, I think, five or six of those cars. And so Al ran that, but I had already gotten him a deal in the Chevrolet Monza because that was the car we felt could win the IMSA championship. So I know this is rather complicated, but at any rate, when we go testing, often Al would put me in the 934. Well, it was a turbocharged 911, but it was evil. It was very, very difficult to drive, basically because it had such terrible lag in the turbo. So you had to do, I learned, for me, it was the perfect teaching tool, because I learned to listen to the sound of the turbo spooling up, and then just, I learned where in that sound where the boost would hit. And when it would hit, it would be like 200 plus horsepower all of a sudden onto the rear wheels. So it it was somewhat abrupt. And you can imagine in the wet, it was a nightmare to drive. But I cut my teeth on that car, and then we were going through the season, and remember, my first race to see was at Mid-Ohio. Well, back then, Les Greedling, the owner of the track, had a race called the Lumberman's 500, which was kind of a, every year it ran under a different set of rules. Well, this particular year, IMSA was the sanctioning body for it, but it ran under rules that Les wrote up. So he wanted the turbo to run against the regular IMSA equipment. So I put together a deal from my hometown with a good friend by the name of Bobby Riggs, not the tennis Bobby Riggs, that owned a little company called Silo Cabinet Shop. And he was a big race fan, mostly Indy cars, sprint cars, and stuff like that. But he gave me sponsorship to drive that car at Mid-Ohio. Well, on the way to the track from Pennsylvania, Al told me, oh, by the way, you're going to have a co-driver. And I said, what? And he said, yeah. And I said, who? He said, I didn't pick him. Les did. Les wants him to drive. And I said, who? And he goes, George. And I said, George? He said, George Fulmer. And George is, you know, George could drive anything. Anything. I swear to God, he was good in everything. He was very impressive. And he's the one guy that could pin Mark Donohue's ears back sometimes if he got his car just right. So I said, yeah, I said, I'll never get in the car. I'll never get to practice. And that was true. I got three laps to practice. And then during the race, George took the lead after probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 laps. He was suddenly leading the race. And I was supposed to do morning warm-up, but he showed up just before I got in the car and said, I just want to check a couple things, and then you get the rest of the session. Well, he'd come in and make a change, and go back out, come in and make a change, go back out, and the 20 minutes was up very quickly. So I never got to go out. And he changed the car drastically. And so what he changed it to is Al had always set up the car with just a tiny bit of push. And George set it up to oversteer. And it would oversteer on entry. Well, so at the first pit stop, I went and hid. I think I might have told you this before, Trish. I went and hid in the Portageon because he was leading the race. I didn't want to go get in the car. I knew there's no way in hell I was going to be able to keep it up there. And so after he came in, did the pit stop, and went back out, I came back to the pits, and the crew goes, where were you? Where were you? Well, don't leave. George says you're getting in the next stop. It's going to be your car. And I said, I don't want to get in. And they said, George is counting on you, Doc. You don't have any choice. So I thought, I'll sneak off when it's getting close to that pit window. So I didn't get to sneak off because he came in early. What had happened was during the pit stop, they had changed the rear tires, and they were center lock wheels, and you have to, when you put them on, there's holes in the wheel that the pegs from the hub have to go into those. You can go beside the holes, and it'll eventually work itself loose. Well, that's what happened, and he felt it. So he came in And you have to change the hub. You have to put another hub on. So he'd come in, get out of the car, and looked at it. It was the left rear. Looked at it as mechanics were changing, you know, that hub. And he looked at me and he says, "All right, get your gear on. It's your turn." And I said, "I'm not driving." And he goes, "Well, it's just going to sit here because I'm done. We're going to lose at least 20 minutes or so." It didn't take him that long. It only took him about 10 minutes. But irregardless, we were, you know, out of the race itself, other than, you know, some position way back. So I go out. I get the team saying, "Get in the car, get in the car, get in the car." So I get in the car. They finish up. They drop it and send me. So I go out, learned a very valuable lesson this time. And I go out under the bridge up to the upper end of the track and get onto the back straightaway. And then, you know, there's traffic everywhere. There's cars everywhere. And I could down the back straightaway really fast. Well, remember I said I'd learned something valuable? I got to the brake point down there. I hit the brake pedal, and it went to the floor. And that's because when they changed the hub, they pulled the brake caliper off, so the pucks weren't up against the brake pads. So my first hit on the brake pedal, my foot never, ever since before then or after then, it's never moved that fast. And I was able to, I spun it off, didn't hit anything, and then got going again. And then I realized the car was just something else completely. It wanted to spin out all the time. And I came around, and Al's father, Bob, was kind of looking after my car. He was doing the times and stuff. And he said, "Well, that wasn't the best outlap, but he's gone by, so he's okay." I go into turn one, and the back end comes around. I spin way out there in the grass. And I thought, "What the heck?" So I got it going, got back on the track, and got around. I came by, and he goes, "Well, that's better, but he's still way off the pace." I go into turn one, around again. So I'm going, "What the heck is going on?" So this happened like three times in a row. And finally on the fourth time, I said, "I'm not going to let this car spin out. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not going to let it spin out." So it just went sideways, but I figured out how to keep it, you know, from spinning off into the grass. And then from that point on, then I drove to the finish of the race. So, and remember, I had said early on that Peter Gregg said I'd never become a driver. Well, he was in the race. He won the race in a BMW. And so I'm sitting on the guardrail. All my friends from Ohio are there, and they're going, "Wow, we saw you spin here." We saw, and the crew's going, "What? He did what?" And they said, "It was spectacular. He never hit anything, but he did so many, you know, pirouettes." And they're laughing, and all of a sudden through the crowd, Peter Gregg walks. And I thought, "Oh, my God, he's going to just throw me under the truck right now." And he goes, "Doc, I know that I told you you'd never be a driver. Why owe you an apology?" He says, "I saw you had some real issues out there, but it doesn't surprise me because George set up the car, and you probably never drove it like that before." I said, "You're right." And he said, "I'll tell you this. For somebody with so little experience, you were the most cooperative car out on the track." He said, "You'd leave room when I would come up on you. You'd leave room for me to get through without, you know, without doing something stupid." And in the background, the whole time I'm hearing, "Peter Gregg, please come to Victory Circle. Peter Gregg, come to Victory Circle. We're waiting on you for ceremonies. And finally, I said, Peter, congratulations. You won the race. You need to get over there. And he walked away. And so it went from figuring, okay, he's going to throw me under the bus, to all my friends, like, their jaws dropped when he complimented me. So that was a really, really good experience in an offhand way. But I never, from that day, I never leave pit lane without touching the brake pedal, ever. I always check it to make sure that it's firm, it's there. Every car I've driven ever since that day. So that was one of the valuable lessons that I had learned.
I want to hear about the 24-hour race you told me about, driving in the dark with no front end on the car.
Oh, again. That was in Mid-Ohio, a 24-hour race at Mid-Ohio. And any of you all that have been to Mid-Ohio, it's not a good place for headlights. There's a lot of cresting hills and off-camber stuff, and it's a very challenging track to drive anyway. But in the dark, it's really challenging. And they had installed I think it was for motorcycles, a little chicane up by turn two, a little carousel. So in that particular race, they decided to run that little chicane. So I was driving a Corvette with Sarah Van der Merwe. Now, they called it showroom stock, but, you know, they weren't showroom stock. They were race cars, but made from production cars. So I was driving with Sarl, Al, and Bobby Unser. And during the night, I went into that chicane, and here's a car sideways in there. Well, I didn't, and it was fast. It was, you'd go in there from fourth, you just drop it back down to third and right back in the power out of it. So it was a fast little section. Well, I went in there, and here's a car sideways in there. So I plowed into it, and I figured, well, that's the end of that. So, but I was able to get the car back to the pits. It was all tore up. I mean, really tore up in the front. So I get back there, and my co-drivers all took one look at the car, and they said, we're going back to the hotel. We'll see you, and left. So the team, I mean, immediately they start pulling broken body panels and stuff off of it and checking alignment and saying, well, this is okay. This is okay. I think this will be okay. And I said, well, can you strap a couple headlights on it some way? So they found a way to put a couple of lights on the front of it. So I go back out. And the thing drives great. So because of my headlight configuration, I think I confused a lot of people. And so they'd see this weird headlight thing coming at them, and they would just kind of let me go through. So I was doing great, and I eventually caught my teammate. And at the time, both our cars were on the same frequency, radio frequency. So I catch up to him, and I start coaching him. Things like, no, you can go deeper here. Go on in. Now go to power. Now. Set the car. Now go to power. And stuff like that. You know, helping him turn better lap times. So we're cruising. We're passing all kinds of people. Well, he had been out there for a while. So that was the only time during the whole race that we actually ran close to each other. And then he went in because, no, yeah, that's right. He went into the pit because he needed fuel. And I still have a half tank, so I'm running around out there. And I kind of get bored. Well, at the time, I didn't realize there was this big tent that they had set up that served meals for the teams. And what I didn't know is my crew went over there to eat something, and they took their radios with them. So I'm on the radio, and I start singing. I can't sing, but I was just so bored that I just started singing some goofy song. What I didn't know is everybody in that tent could hear what I was doing, and they're laughing, and the crew's going, "Can you believe him? Can you believe him?" And I used to play tricks in the 24 hours at Daytona, and I didn't do it so much at Sebring, but at Daytona and in these one-off 24-hour races, I would, in the middle of the night, I'd say, "Oh God," like that, and then not say anything else over the radio, because I knew in the pits they're all like half asleep, and so they'd come back, "What's going on? What happened? What happened? Are you all right?" And I go, "Yeah, I'm fine. Just looking for a draft." I was always looking for a draft, get a little more speed. So that was my Mid-Ohio. That was my Mid-Ohio experience. I have no idea where we finished, but we, that poor ugly car, we finished the race with it.
I'd like to see a picture of that.
Oh, and because my teammates never come back, you know, I drove, you're only supposed to drive like 4 hours. Well, I drove like 5 hours straight. And I said, "Guys, you got to find somebody to drive the car." So they found, I think it was a journalist. And he, you know, he saw the car go by and he's going, "I don't know if I want to drive that." And they go, "He's going great. He says it handles fine. He needs relief. Please, will you get in?" So, they, you know, on the fuel stop, the next fuel stop, they said, "You can get out. We got a co-driver." And I said, "Okay."
Who was it?
I can't tell you because I don't remember for the life of me. But he did good.
I can think of several that would.
And, you know, he drove it, I think, two stints. And then I finished the race. And after the race, I was so used up. When I come in, got out of the car, laid down in the grass there by the, you know, by the guardrail, and I just went to sleep. I was so exhausted. And so they loaded everything up, and then they came and said, "Oh, is Doc still down at the pit?" "Yeah, he's sleeping down there." And so they came, woke me up, and said, "Come on, Doc, we're going to go back to the hotel so you can shower, and we're going to dinner." So it was some experience. But, you know, I just loved driving so much. I didn't care. I just wanted to drive.
Well, when you're not driving, you're doing consulting and coaching and part-time track announcing. What do you like doing?
I don't like riding anymore. I had a near-death experience riding with a journalist. So I pass on that. And you know, we've lost some instructors because of people that do dumb things in a race car, a fast race car, and they're trying to impress the instructor. And the last thing in the world we want is impressed. The way to impress an instructor is to do everything correctly. Keep the car on the track. Make your apexes and your brake points and you're, you know, drive correctly. It just takes concentration and understanding your limits and a car's limits. You drive within your limits. And in time, you get faster because you realize, okay, I can take this, I can get back into the power a little sooner or whatever. And you start learning about what the car likes, you know, to be able to roll into the power sooner. So it kind of goes hand in hand. I'm a feel driver. And a lot of guys nowadays, because of all the data systems, you can lay down a lap with the data system and then show them, okay, this is where I break, and this is, you know, and they can compare themselves to you. But I'm still old school. I like them to develop feel, to feel the tires, to feel the chassis. You know, there's so much feedback. A car can tell you so much if you just are sensitive to it and feel what's going on. Just going out and driving, you know, to this point, slam on the brakes, back on the power and stuff like that. That might be fast, but I prefer the art of driving.
Gotcha.
And so I teach that way. I prefer to teach that way. And I think it becomes more enjoyable for the driver. Once he understands,
driving is easier. It would seem to me driving smoothly is an art, but it's an acquired thing. But still, it would be so much easier than slamming your car all over.
Well, and that's the thing, you know. I've finished races with cars that were having issues, and I did that because I got what the car could give me without abusing it. And I think that comes from feel. And I think, you know, if you have that, not every race goes the way you plan, or you're not always the fastest, but that doesn't mean you can't still win. There's other ways to win. And I was, for many years, I was not all that good at qualifying, and, you know, to pull that one perfect lap out. But I didn't worry about it. I always, when I was on the track, I was always thinking about the long run, you know, keeping my tires good for the long run, keeping my brakes good, the gearbox, and not missing shifts and, you know, things like that. That was more important to me. I come up in an era, and because I didn't have sponsorship behind me or somebody to pay for the ride for me, the owners would say, bring it back, just like we give it to you. So I learned I had to take care of the car. I learned that. I think that's a big reason why I'm still getting to drive at this point in my career, over 50 years. I never planned to run this long, but I just love it, and I can't imagine doing anything else. I'm not qualified for anything else.
Does anybody have any questions out there?
I put everybody to sleep.
You know,
I put everybody to sleep.
Hello?
Yep.
Hey, it's Janet.
Hey, Janet.
Hey, Doc. How about telling everybody how you feel? I don't know if I'm it's a little bit late getting in, but tell everybody, you've been through COVID and heart issues, and tell everybody how you're doing.
I'm doing well. I was at the heart doctor last week, and evidently I have still some issue, and they think it's scar tissue in my heart. So my heart's not working at full capacity. My lungs are great. My strength is much, much better, all those things. But evidently my heart's not quite where they want to see it yet. So I'm not sure what will happen next, but I'm hopeful that I can get everything working correctly. I told Tricia earlier and Dave that I'm so sore today. I was so proud of getting my virus shot yesterday, and it was like nothing. I got up this morning, I was so sore and stiff, I could barely move. So I laid around almost the whole day. I did take Bandit for his two walks, but that was a chore. But I truly am doing better, and I'm hopeful that I can get strong enough to get back behind the wheel this year. I want to run the midi.
The car is waiting for you.
Yeah, I want to run the midi. They have a new car they're building for me. The F1 car is, they got the tub back. It's been completely rebuilt. So,
is this that Lotus?
Yep.
I haven't seen it.
It's the tub was what had happened the last couple of years when we ran it. We'd make a change, and the car wouldn't respond to the change. You know, it was no different than it was just prior. And that car is not like that. So I said to him, I said, I think this thing has become very flexible. Well, it had. You know, it was built in 78, so it's got a lot of years on it. 40 years, something like that. So, you know, it's an aluminum tub, and just 40 years of wringing her heart out just wore out. So they had to replace all the skin on the tub. So it's a bit, the crew tell me it's a bit heavier, about 12 pounds heavier, but it's very, very strong now. So I'm looking forward to driving it.
What class is that?
It's, we run it in the Masters. So it's F1 cars, and they have a couple different eras. So it was the first, the Lotus 79 was the first of the ground effect cars.
Mm-hmm.
The best one over there appears to be the Williams, which was about 2 years after the Lotus.
Is that flying shirts?
Yeah, no, and they don't allow us to run. See, the Lotus was developed with the sliding skirts, but they don't allow us to run those. So we don't have the downforce that the Williams has. And they had changed the engine rules, and our engine had been built for 12,500 RPM, and they put a limit of 10,000. You couldn't rev it over 10,000. Well, that cost me, believe it or not, it cost me 60 horsepower. So the last 2 years that I ran it, it was just, you know, I'd be all over their butts in the corners and then watch them drive away like I had an anchor on me or something. So it was very frustrating.
You'll work it
out. I like to be competitive.
I didn't get that.
What are you announcing? What we got going on in the future?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Yeah, why don't you announce what we got going on in the future, and we'll wind this up here and keep talking after I stop the recording.
Oh yeah. I'm sorry, I did not understand you. Our next guest in 2 weeks, or is it 3 weeks, is Bob Varsha. Everybody knows Bob Varsha. Yes.
Yeah, great guy. I did some broadcasts with him in the 80s. He's a super guy, super nice guy. And he's gone through one hell of a challenge himself. So
yeah, it's interesting we have y'all back to back, but that's not why the choices were made. The sickover day. Yeah, we almost lost him too.
Yeah.
I think he was more worried about his hair than anything. Because he had COVID and cancer.
Yeah.
But I think he's doing better.
Yeah. I think Janet told me that they'd misdiagnosed the cancer he had, so they were treating him for something different than what he actually had.
That's what I heard later, too. And I thought, how can they do that?
Yeah, really.
Well, just to let y'all know, Bob's hair looks beautiful again, so it's okay.
Good. I wish I could borrow some of that. Mine's so thin. That's all right.
I told Bob he'd grow back out, and he'd look like a, what is it, those fuzzy dogs? Bark-a-doodle or something like that.
Okay, Trish, wind us up.
We're going to wind up. Everybody was fantastic. I wish they'd ask more questions, but I know that they're enjoying it out there. At least we all hope they are, and we're just grateful that they joined us tonight. And you can hear replays of this episode on Dave's website anytime you want. We have an archives, and I'm real pleased to hear that. And so tell your friends, join us next time with Bob Varsha, and everybody have a very good night.